The views expressed in the following program are those of the writers and producers and do not necessarily reflect the views of KORC, its underwriters, or community airwaves.
This is KORC 105.9 LPFM, Corvallis, Oregon, streaming at korcfm.com.
Let's ask a question. What is Project 2025? Here's the answer. Let's see if you like it. Project 2025, also known as the Presidential Transition Project, is a collection of policy proposals to thoroughly reshape the United States federal government in the event of a Republican victory in the 2024 U.S. presidential election. It's a conservative's conservative plan to change the United States as we know it. It is based on four pillars, as the project folks call it. To quote their website, project2025.org. The project will create a playbook of actions to be taken in the first 180 days of the new administration to bring quick relief to Americans suffering from the left's devastating policies. A policy agenda, presidential personnel database, and a presidential administration policy, end quote. The project will build on four pillars that will collectively pave the way for an effective conservative administration: policy, personnel, training, and a 180-day playbook. The project is the effort of a broad coalition of conservative organizations that have come together to, quote, ensure a successful administration begins in January 2025. With the right conservative policy recommendations and properly vetted and trained personnel to implement them, we will take back our government, end quote. The 2025 Presidential Transition Project is being organized by the Heritage Foundation, which has been highly influential for presidential administration since the Reagan era. Most recently, the Trump administration relied heavily on Heritage's mandate for policy guidance, embracing nearly two-thirds of Heritage's proposals within just 1 year of office. Just like Islam, the right's Project 2025 is based on pillars. First is a policy agenda extending to every branch of government and curated by the most conservative possible cabinet. Second is a presidential personnel database, meaning loyalty to Trump above anything and everything else. A presidential administration academy will train the next ultra-conservative wave. The fourth pillar of Project 2025 is a 180-day transition playbook and includes a comprehensive, concrete transition plan for each federal agency. Quote, only through the implementation of specific action plans at each agency will the next conservative presidential administration be successful. End quote. Many conservative voices are contributing to this so-called project, but none more loudly than Steve Bannon. Wait, you say, isn't he now in jail? That's okay. Conservatives seem to relish convicted criminals as long as they're old and white. Let's peruse some of the articles we see at project2025.org. Five things you can do right now to help dismantle the federal bureaucracy. Policies in the current federal government that prioritize reliable, affordable energy over reducing emissions at any cost will be gone. Looking for a few good conservatives to deconstruct the administrative state in 2025? The four-point game plan for a conservative president to dismantle the deep state that undermined Trump. Well, I believe you get the drift. The drift to the right will become a stampede if a recently convicted criminal president is returned to office in January 2025. When Project 2025 will change America into Germany 1933. For KORC News, I'm Lava Lamp Larry.
You may have noticed a new housing complex under construction in South Corvallis on the corner of Highway 99 and Wake Robin Avenue. Here's a little info on the new development. The Unionet Pacific Highway is being developed by the Annex Group. It's on 7 acres and will offer 174 apartments to those earning less than 60% of our area's median income. It will include 1, 2, and 3-bedroom apartments, a community center, a fitness center, playground, gardens, a dog park, activity rooms, a picnic area, and other amenities. Major demand is expected from OSU students, and the complex will be operated under the Low Income Housing Tax Credit Program, created in 1986 as part of the Tax Reform Act. According to the Annex Group, the project budget is $56 million, and according to the Department of Housing and Urban Development, a single Corvallis resident must earn less than $45,360 annually to qualify for affordable rental housing. For some context on the housing crisis in Oregon, in 2023, Governor Tina Kotek tried unsuccessfully to pass a Senate bill aiming to expand zoning for housing in Oregon cities by easing restrictions on such development. Numerous bills have faced opposition from environmental advocates in recent years, who note that new laws would allow urban sprawl to replace natural areas and farmland, including crucial habitats like wetlands. In the past half century, Oregon state laws have somewhat restricted urban sprawl relative to other states, something residents and lawmakers appear to value. Now in 2024, Governor Kotek has negotiated with lawmakers to address city infrastructure and add qualifications for rezoning and expansion. Senate Bills 1530 and 1537, along with House Bill 4134, together would make for a $376 million investment in infrastructure funding, home building, homeless shelters, and rental assistance. Governor Kotek's new proposal would allow cities outside the Portland metro area with populations above 25,000 to expand by 100 acres, down from 150 in her initial efforts. But not before proving that they need more land and ensuring that at least 30% of new housing would be defined as affordable. $75 million of the new proposal would be used for a revolving loan fund that cities could allocate to low and moderate income housing targeted at people who don't qualify for affordable housing but still earn too little to afford buying a home at current prices. Another $65 million would keep homeless shelters operating, and $34 million would aim to provide rent assistance to struggling Oregonians. Last March, Governor Kotek stated that she may seek to loosen restrictions on city expansion set forth in the new laws, depending on whether the bills succeed in their goals.
You're listening to KORC. I'm Nick Martin. The city of Corvallis may have to consider refunding potentially hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of fees improperly collected from property developers. This was just one of the recommendations made by Benton County Circuit Court Judge Joan DeMarest in a December lawsuit against the city. The plaintiff in the suit, local property developer Jim Boder, claims the city wrongly billed him for what are called infrastructure cost recovery fees, or ICR fees, on two parcels he planned to develop in southwest Corvallis. In the year 2000, the city adopted a law to start collecting ICR fees. According to the Corvallis Municipal Code, these fees are meant to collect for the initial cost of providing a basic level of public infrastructure from developers when they apply for connection and did not previously pay their share of the cost for construction of those basic infrastructures. This means when a newly built house needs to be connected to sewers, sidewalks, water lines, etc., instead of paying for new sewers, sidewalks, water lines, etc., the developer pays a fee toward the original cost of putting in those infrastructures. When the city assessed Boder's properties, they calculated the ICR he owed at $65,400 because there would need to be improvements made to the adjacent Country Club Drive. This is the point where Boder finds fault because, as he argues, Country Club is a collector street built for the use of the greater community, while 47th Street, the street the parcels face, is a local street, and the municipal code states that ICR charges can only be made to local streets. In an email to the city manager, Boder stated his properties will not be utilizing Country Club's infrastructure. he made an appeal to the Corvallis Public Works director at the time, then to city manager Mark Shepard, which were both denied. He eventually took it to the city council in January of 2020, where the councilors ultimately sided with the city manager's opinion in an 8-1 vote, agreeing that he had not acted arbitrarily or capriciously when denying Mr. Boder's appeal. After another failed attempt to bring the case to the Land Use Board of Appeals, it finally came in front of Judge Demarest at the Circuit Court. In her opinion, quoted from the official record, this is what the judge found. Quote, "The court finds that the City of Corvallis did not follow the plain language of the Corvallis Municipal Code in applying, calculating, and collecting infrastructure cost recovery charges related to plaintiff's, Mr. Boder's, real property," unquote. She further states that the errors were in the City Council's confusion on the matter during the January meeting, City Attorney conflict of interest at the meeting, and possible mishandling of the matter by the City Manager. Under the judge's orders, she annulled the January 2020 City Council vote, finding that the City Manager Mark Shepard did not act arbitrarily or capriciously, and ordered that the City refund Mr. Boder his full ICR payments plus 9% per year within 30 days of the opinion letter, then ordered the City conduct a proper hearing for him. She also recommended the City should conduct an independent audit of the ICR collection methods to consider the scope of the problem and consider refunding improperly collected ICR fees, saying all ICR charges since the original passage of the law back in November 2000 are suspect. Both Mr. Boder and the City were not aware of the judge's opinion letter until recently, when the former City attorneys transferred their documents to the new attorneys. According to the Gazette Times, both parties are working on a final order for the court. Thank you to the Gazette Times article entitled, "Judge Takes Corvallis to Task for Way It Collects Developers' Fees," for some of the information provided in this story. You're listening to KORC.
You're listening to KORC, News, Music, and Civics. I'm going to read an article from the Oregon Capital Chronicle from this week. And the headline reads, "Oregon lags most states in public higher education funding, a report finds." And the author is Alex Baumhard. Oregon State University in Corvallis is one of the most expensive public 4 years in the state to attend. The university, along with the 6 other public universities in Oregon, is raising tuition for students next year. The Oregon legislature continues to spend far less on higher education than other states, according to a new report, leading to some of the highest costs of attendance among universities in the West. Oregon is ranked 44th in the nation for public funding of higher education and 37th in the nation for per pupil funding, according to the latest annual State Higher Education Finance Report from the Colorado-based State Higher Education Executive Officers Association. Oregon's Higher Education Coordinating Commission, HECC, is also a member of that association. The report compared state-by-state funding data from the 2022-23 fiscal year. While higher education investment in Oregon has increased in recent years, it has not been enough to make up for more than a decade of underfunding and of relying heavily on student tuition to cover rising costs, according to Ben Hannon, the executive director of that commission. Cannon and university presidents have repeatedly asked the legislature for more higher education dollars and a model of funding that balances state investment with tuition revenue. Cannon said, "We are continuing to rely on students to balance our budgets." Enrollment declines across Oregon's 7 public universities and 17 community colleges over the last 5 to 10 years have been more than twice the national average, according to the report, making tuition an unreliable source of funding. Cannon said, "Over the next 10 years, or whatever portion of that 10 years I'm around for, I will hope to partner with the legislature to restore the public in our public system of higher education. Per pupil investment in Oregon's public higher education system was more than $2,500 less than the national average last year, according to the Higher Education Finance Report. In Oregon, during the 2022-23 school year, the state invested about $8,400 per full-time enrolled student each year. The national average that year was more than $11,000 per student. State investments in financial aid for middle and low-income students have increased in the last decade, but still fall behind national averages. Washington invests twice as much funding in scholarships for such students compared to Oregon. Quote, "You have a situation in Oregon right now where the vast majority of Oregon's public university presidents are from outside of the state, and we're shocked," said Eastern Oregon University President Kelly Ryan, who took over in 2023. Quote, "We are shocked at what we found. And we're also in wonderment about how we're supposed to get our work done in such a drastically underfunded environment," unquote. Ryan had to cut 8.4% of the university's budget for the 2023-24 school year, which was about $5 million. She said they, meaning the legislature, acknowledge were really important to building a tax base, building a workforce, but it's hard for us to stay front and center, unquote. Oregon's higher education funding model has relied since the 2008 recession more heavily than many other states on raising tuition to cover rising operational costs, with funding since then cut in half. Quote, "A whole lot of students took on a whole lot of debt in order to help the state keep its corrections department, human services department, and K-12 systems afloat during the worst recession anyone had seen in their living memories," unquote, said Ben Cannon. Oregon's public universities and colleges now derive 32% more of their revenue from tuition than most public higher education institutions in the country. Between 2013 and 2023, revenue growth from student tuition in Oregon increased by 23%. The national average for tuition revenue growth was 1.5% during that same period. Every one of Oregon's seven public universities is increasing tuition in the upcoming school year and has done so just about every year for the past 10 years. Average tuition at those schools today is about 26% higher than it was a decade ago. The rising costs of housing around Oregon's universities have also driven up costs and affordability concerns, according to Cannon. He said, "A state that invests relatively little is going to have institutions that are likely going to have relatively high tuition." And that's absolutely what this report illustrates, he told the Capital Chronicle. This story, again, was from the Oregon Capital Chronicle and was written by Alex Baumhard. You're listening to KORC.
If ever you're walking down the waterfront on any given morning, whether it be cloudy, sunny, probably not rainy, but if it's any day like we've been experiencing lately, you've heard the saxophone player. You've heard these notes fill the streets of downtown. And so it was on Tuesday morning, as I walked into downtown, the river to my right, the trees aglow with a mid-morning summer sun, I heard these notes. It was a weekday morning. Most people were at work. Downtown was quiet. Coffee shops were serving drink to people who needed a pick-me-up. Restaurants were just starting to open up for lunch. And the bars were stocking their shelves for the night to come. My friend Isabel was with me when we came upon the saxophone player, and we stopped to talk with the person behind the notes. Let's check it out. Yeah, well, what's your name?
Oh, Chris Hansen.
Chris Hansen?
Yeah.
Good to meet you, Chris.
Yeah.
How long have you been playing saxophone for?
55 years.
55 years. What got you started?
I went and heard a sax when I was 6 years old, and I said, Mom, I want to do that.
And the rest is history.
Yeah, the up and down.
Up and down?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You lived in Corvallis most of your life? Or?
No, I've been here 7 years.
7 years? Yeah, I've been here about 7 years,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, so I'm a newcomer, you know. Being a professional musician, do you have to go to big cities?
You do.
And I was tired of big cities.
Yeah.
So I used to live in Las Vegas, man, and it was cool when I got there, but it went from 300,000 to 1.2 million in 12 years, you know.
Wow.
Yeah. Where are you from?
I'm from Colorado.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah. What about you?
Well, I'm from San Diego originally, which is...
Yes. Yeah.
Are you interested in learning any other instruments?
I do play them. I play all the woodwinds.
Oh, awesome.
So, I majored in bassoon.
In bassoon?
Yeah.
That's cool. I love the bassoon.
In Las Vegas, we had 500 sax players. Just union.
Just in the union?
Yeah.
Okay.
And of all of those, three of us played bassoon. So
yeah.
They called me for the open job at MGM.
Wow.
Yeah, they that's had no, well, they had no choice.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, for one of three
of
the saxophone players
to
play bassoon. All right, Chris. Well, thanks for talking to us.
Oh,
you
want
to play us out?
Sure.
Yeah. Well, imagine that. Being one of a small handful of bassoon players in a city of 1.2 million people. And when a band has need for it, they'll call you up. Maybe even call you up on the big stage. That was Chris Hansen, playing saxophone at downtown Corvallis. And you can hear him in any given morning between 11 and 1, whenever he feels like it. This was Corvallis Community Update. Thanks for listening.
Check, check, hey, this is Phil Farrell for KORC, Civics and News Hour. So this next week, June 19th, is Juneteenth. This is a day commemorating the freedom of slaves after the end of the Civil War back in 1866. It is now a federal holiday as of 2021. Now, a lot of people may think slavery and racial segregation is a problem of the South, problem of the East, the Midwest, but Oregon's own history has a very big chapter on racial segregation, including Oregon's black exclusion laws. Now, these were laws actually banning black people from settling into the state of Oregon. passing with almost 9-to-1 approval rate. The first of these laws took effect in 1844, where they excluded black settlers at the border. These laws were put in place to try to keep the new state of Oregon a white state, and were fueled by the fears of the black free population encouraging an uprising amongst the Native American population, who much of their land had been taken after both unintentional and intentional disease spreading and physical murder. More black exclusion laws were passed in Oregon for the removal of black and mulatto residents, which was a term referring to people of mixed race of black descent. These laws were punishable by whipping, stating no less than 20, no more than 39 strikes for every 6 months they stayed in the state. More segregation laws were passed in Oregon, with the final law stating that Negroes and mulattoes could not reside in the state, and Chinamen, a discriminatory term for people of Eastern Asian descent, could not own land or vote in the state. This led to an eventual 80% decline of the Chinese and Eastern Asian population in Oregon. And the black exclusion laws are a main reason of the low percentage of black population in Oregon, even of today. Now, these laws became invalid after the ratification of the 14th Amendment after the end of the Civil War in 1868, but weren't repealed from Oregon's state constitution until 1926, where it passed with only a 62.5% vote in approval of repealing. In 2002, there was a vote to remove all the racial references from the Oregon Constitution. This passed, but with only a 71% approval vote. Now, the reason I bring this topic up is to bring awareness. I think it's a subject that is not taught enough in both the teachings of racial segregation in the United States, civil rights movement, and in Oregon's own history. Some people think segregation is a thing of the past, but it is present today, even in our own community. So I just want to bring awareness to such facts, because awareness and discussion to me is the best way to solve these problems. As a community, it's hard to fix problems that the majority of people aren't aware of. So please go out and do your own research. There's many more facts that myself, even I, need to go look up and learn more about. And I'm always learning more, and I appreciate being able to be on KORC and share a little bit. So shouts out to all the listeners out there. Appreciate it. Again, this is Phil Farrell for KORC, Civics and News. Stay tuned for more. Have a great day. Thank you.
I'm exhausted. Last night I couldn't sleep, but when I did, I could hear bombs in my dreams. Nightmare situation. How could they be so evil? Making martyrs out of children and innocent people. We expect the bombs, not knowing where next. Huddle in the corner of my room, trying to protect my little brother as the building shakes like it's possessed. But nothing stronger than the will of the oppressed. I bomb back with my lyrics and rhymes, living the times, trying to break the Palestinian minds. What's hiding in the clouds hanging over my head? My dad risks his life outside to buy bread. The fourth war in my 12th year. At this stage I'm numb, though I haven't feel scared. There's nothing I can do in this case to stay safe. I'm brave, even though this house could be in my grave. I want freedom for the population. 2 million prisoners living in this location. Shouting at the wall, but nothing is ever changing. That's life under an occupation. I want freedom for the population. 2 million prisoners living in this location. Shouting at the wall, but nothing is ever changing. That's life under an occupation. Mothers mourn, fighting with grief. White sheets covered by his death. Lie on the streets, buildings turn to ash, but my mind is made of steel. So it doesn't take much for me to heal. Won't lose the will to live or lose our minds. My auntie lost her home, so she lost her life. But she is still alive, but traumatized by the bombs that flew in and dropped that night. My sister couldn't sleep, tried to stop her cries. I said it was fireworks, I was telling her lies. Where's the compassion? This is heartless. It's like they want us all living in darkness. Cutting off water and electricity for hours. They're knocking towers, but that's not knocking the power that I have in my pen. When I'm writing, I'm unstoppable. The microphone is the only escape possible, cause that's the way that I can speak my mind. I wonder how does the fighter pilot sleep at night, knowing he can turn the city upside down all of a sudden. Slaughtering families with the push of a button. I want freedom for the population. 2 million prisoners just living in this location. Shouting at the wall, but nothing is ever changing. That's life under an occupation. I want freedom for the population. 2 million prisoners living in this location. Shouting at the wall, but nothing is ever changing. That's life under an occupation.
You're listening to KORC, News, Music, and Civics. KORC is proud to provide segments from Democracy Now! On a weekly basis. For more information on national and international news, visit democracynow.org.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Excellencies, the horror must stop. It's high time for a ceasefire, along with the unconditional release of hostages. I welcome the peace initiative recently outlined by President Biden and urge all parties to seize this opportunity and come to an agreement.
As calls grow for Israel and Hamas to back a ceasefire and hostage deal in Gaza, the World Health Organization's warning over 8,000 Palestinian children have been diagnosed with acute malnutrition. We look at the ethics crisis at the Supreme Court. I'm Amy Goodman. The official death toll in Gaza has topped 37,200 people, nearly 16,000 of them children, with more than 85,000 injured. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, head of the World Health Organization, warned famine spreading in Gaza.
A significant proportion of Gaza's population is now facing catastrophic hunger and famine-like conditions. Despite reports of increased delivery of food, there is currently no evidence that those who need it most are receiving sufficient quantity and quality of food.
This comes as deadly Israeli attacks continue across the Gaza Strip. Fresh attacks on the Nusairat refugee camp have killed at least 5 people, while Israeli soldiers are using explosives to level buildings in the center of Rafah. Meanwhile, Israel's far-right finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, said this week he will confiscate some $35 million in Palestinian tax revenue and transfer the money to Israeli families who've lost relatives in Palestinian attacks. On the diplomatic front, world leaders from the G7 nations are meeting in Italy, where the U.S. says it'll push its allies to back its proposed Gaza ceasefire deal. Hamas has responded to the proposal, but on Wednesday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said some of the group's requested changes are not workable. Hamas responded in a statement, quote, "While Blinken continues to talk about Israel's approval of the proposal, we've not heard any Israeli official voicing approval," Hamas said. The Republican-controlled House of Representatives Wednesday voted to hold Attorney General Merrick Garland in contempt of Congress for refusing to turn over audio of President Biden's interview with Special Counsel Robert Hur. The Justice Department has already released the full transcript of the interview. Hur was tasked with investigating Biden's handling of classified material. He did not bring any charges against Biden, but Republicans claim they need the audio as part of their impeachment effort against the president. New York Democrat Jerry Nadler blasted his Republican colleagues as he spoke from the House floor.
The Judiciary Committee under Republican control has spent the last 18 months and $20 million taxpayer dollars in a desperate search to find something, anything, that they can use to damage President Biden and to protect Donald Trump.
The Justice Department, which Garland oversees, is not expected to prosecute Garland. In other news from Capitol Hill, Senate Republicans Wednesday blocked a Democratic bid to pass ethics and transparency legislation for the Supreme Court amidst mounting corruption scandals around the court's far-right justices. Meanwhile, in the House, Congressmembers Jamie Raskin and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez have announced a new ethics bill for the Supreme Court, which AOC said has been, quote, captured and corrupted by money and extremism.
the constitutional and democratic crisis and threat that this current corruption crisis on the court presents is a threat not just to American way of life and American democracy, but it is a threat to our lives. People have died and are dying after the Dobbs decision. People have died and can die with the rollbacks of environmental provisions.
This comes as newly published audio recordings show Justice Samuel Alito lashing out at ProPublica, which exposed Clarence Thomas for accepting lavish gifts from conservative billionaire Harlan Crow over decades. The Southern Baptist Convention has voted to oppose in vitro fertilization, a statement approved Wednesday by delegates to the church's annual meeting in Indianapolis. Calls on Southern Baptists to, quote, reaffirm the unconditional value and right to life of every human being, including those in an embryonic stage, unquote. Southern Baptists are the largest Protestant denomination in the U.S., with nearly 13 million members. Their opposition to IVF comes just months after Alabama's Supreme Court ruled frozen embryos have the same rights as children. In climate news, Capitol Police arrested eight climate activists Wednesday after they rushed the field of the annual congressional baseball game in Washington, D.C. Ahead of the protests, the group Climate Defiance blasted game organizers for allowing Chevron to co-sponsor the game and noted Congress has failed to pass a single climate change bill this year. This comes a day after police in New York arrested dozens of climate activists as they held a protest outside the headquarters of Citibank, which continues to invest hundreds of billions of dollars in the fossil fuel industry. Among those arrested was Dr. Sandra Steingraber, a senior scientist with the Science and Environmental Health Network.
Why are you getting arrested?
I'm a biologist. I'm not interested in writing eulogies for the species that I study, said Dr. Steingraber as she was being arrested. Meanwhile, indigenous-led climate activists rallied outside the White House this week, demanding President Biden halt the flow of oil through the Dakota Access Pipeline. This is Doug Crow Ghost, water director of the Standing Rock Sioux.
We come to you as Standing Rock and Cheyenne River youth, members of this country, members before the United States was even the United States, before states were states, we were a people of this country, this nation, this indigenous land. We are indigenous children. We are here to protect the water, the land, the air, and the environment.
The protest came as the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission gave the go-ahead for the highly contested Mountain Valley Pipeline to begin operating. The 300-mile pipeline is set to carry 2 billion cubic feet of frack gas daily through Virginia and West Virginia, despite vocal opposition from local communities and environmental groups. In another setback for the global climate movement, Swiss lawmakers have rejected a landmark ruling by the European Court of Human Rights, which found in April Switzerland violated the rights of older women by failing to impose policies curbing the climate crisis. The group of women plaintiffs called the Swiss government's response a betrayal. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, officials say at least 42 people were killed by suspected rebels with the Allied Democratic Forces in the eastern province of North Kivu. This comes as more than 80 people were killed in a shipwreck on Kwa River. The DRC has far fewer paved roads than other nations, leading residents to more frequently travel by boat, often in unsafe conditions. In Kuwait, at least 49 people were killed when a fire swept through an overcrowded six-story building housing immigrant workers in the city of Mangaf. Dozens more have been hospitalized for burns and smoke inhalation. Most of the victims were Indian nationals. Under Kuwait's kafala system, foreign workers who make up the majority of the private sector workforce have weak labor protections and are barred from forming unions. Argentina's Senate has narrowly passed far-right libertarian President Javier Milei's highly contested reform bill. As lawmakers debated the measure Wednesday, protesters outside the National Congress in Buenos Aires were met with riot police who deployed tear gas and made multiple arrests. Among other things, the bill imposes sweeping austerity and privatization measures and slashes labor rights. Opposition Senator Martin Lestoux spoke during Wednesday's debate.
This bill gives everything, instantly and forever, to the big companies. And it tells pensioners to wait. The big companies get less taxes and tax stability for 30 years. In the tax package, Argentina's biggest millionaires get less taxes and stability for 15 years. But pensioners who contributed for 30 years don't even know how much money they'll get next month.
Among the planned spending cuts is the dissolution of the government office dealing with gender violence. The head of that office, Claudia Barcia, resigned last week. The bill must now go back to the lower house, which already approved an earlier version in April. The measure could be fully approved later today. And in Ecuador, activists are holding 2 days of protests to oppose plans by the government of Daniel Noboa to cut fuel subsidies. This is Nelson Erazo, leader of the General Union of Workers of Ecuador.
The homes of the workers cannot stand another blow to their economy. The measures adopted, such as a rise in the value-added tax, caused an elevation to the already high cost of living. Consequently, that incremented the price of fuel. This condemns most Ecuadorian households to poverty and misery.
Can't Help Myself, Sugar Pie Honey Bunch by Motown legends The Four Tops. One of the group's members, Alexander Morris, is suing the Detroit area Ascension Hospital to, quote, protect the younger generations from racism and health care after he sought help for chest pain and trouble breathing after a history of heart problems. When the famous singer expressed security concerns about possible stalkers, he said the staff failed to check his ID and instead put him in a straitjacket and ordered a psychological evaluation, quote, despite his clear symptoms of cardiac distress. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
That was Democracy Now! From June 13th, 2024. For more information about national and international news, visit democracynow.org. You're listening to KORC.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. I'm Trevor Sayre. On Monday, June 17th at 6 p.m., the Corvallis City Council will be holding a meeting at the downtown fire station in the Council Chambers, 400 Northwest Harrison Boulevard. The meeting will be held in person and virtually. See CorvallisOregon.gov for the meeting agenda and how to attend online. On Tuesday, June 18th at 6:30 p.m., the Planning Commission will be conducting an online-only meeting. More information, including on how to join the meeting, at CorvallisOregon.gov. On Thursday, June 20th at 4 p.m., there will be a City Council work session held in person at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, 500 Southwest Madison Avenue. For more information on the meeting, including on how to join the meeting virtually, see CorvallisOregon.gov. For KORC News, Music, and Civics, I'm Trevor Sayre.
The following interview is with Hezekiah Franklin and was originally done on May 18th of this year. Hezekiah is a community member who is also a musician and artist and who works and volunteers at the Drop-In Center. Let's listen to Hezekiah's interview again. You're listening to KORC, News, Music, and Civics. Hi everyone, this is JC, and I'm sitting here today near the Saturday Market talking with Hezekiah, a local musician here. He's testing out his drums to see how the sound is. Because it's cooler out today, he's checking how tight the drums are. So Hezekiah, you mentioned something earlier about coming here to the Saturday market and being in a different spot, and now you feel like you're a lot of musicians here are kind of isolated and put back away from the crowd. How long have you been coming to the market like this, playing your drums?
I've been in Corvallis for 15 years, and not until probably about 7 or 8 years into me being here did I start to, like, I had the right setup, so I played in the market, something that's serene and beautiful, for a couple years, and then COVID hit, and then I started playing right here.
Okay, so when you say right here, for those of you that can't see us, we're off Monroe, and we're back behind the main walking area of the market, amongst the trees. Last time I saw you, we were at the dedication to the new skate bowl, and you said something that I thought was really important about culture. Do you remember that at all?
I'm just the culture of skateboarding, which is, then we're talking about skateboarding, then that's usually a basically super counterculture, and the people that come down there are of different thoughts, and also people who drink and smoke down there is basically rebels and outlaws and so on and so forth like that, and even little kids. But as of the, I'm originally from Michigan, and coming to Oregon, how much there is not that much culture here, because a lot of it's basically cowboys and red-bearded lumberjacks and all that stuff. So the stuff that I'm doing is invoking a different kind of culture, because I'm thinking the culture that's perpetuating is predominantly rock and roll, punk, and folk, and that has not manifested anything, you know, like no gods coming down to earth or anything like that. So if we keep on perpetuating that, we're gonna have the same results. Same thing with the politicians, same thing with the religions. Keep on chanting those mantras to, like, a god that's went offline and expected something to happen out of it.
So you mentioned also how the skate bowl and just the culture of the skateboarding brings a positivity to that area that it needs, too. I remember you saying something about that.
Well, yeah, because that area is basically, looks like a bomb went off, and there's garbage, and there's people yelling, there's people ODing. And when I used to be here, everybody was just down by the river, like, jumping in their neck and all that stuff. We didn't have to worry about, like, camps and all that stuff. You can go for a walk without, you know, hearing, you know, the death knell of the failed society. So it has changed a lot. And then their solution now, right now, is basically is sweep people all over the place and, like, live in the parks. And parks are meant for, like, people playing frisbee and kids playing all that stuff. And why then also, like, they want people to be in the parks, but they don't provide a actual legitimate spot or any porta potty. So it's basically like sleep in the park where kids play and take dumps in the grass.
Absolutely, yeah. And I mean, I know they've got that hotel.
Yeah, I'm at the motel right now, but that's going to be demolished June 30th. It's going to turn into, that was going to be, it's a transitional house, and then it's going to turn into a 30 to 50 unit permanent supportive housing. Yeah, the mixture of permanent supportive housing and tiny houses are 100% success, and they're spending about $30,000 every time they sweep people. That could have been used basically to get people rehabilitated on their foot. I've seen people, once they got a shower and a toilet, within 2 weeks they look like a new person.
Absolutely. So you also work at the drop-in center. Tell us a little bit about that and your work there.
Basically, I was going to the drop-in center since I've been here, and it's been many different locations, and then I joined the board, and then during COVID I became a volunteer, then I became staff. Basically, a drop-in center is basically a hub to get people connected to services, and we don't force people to do anything. They connect to the service, they can get the bare essentials, like, you know, a sack, lunch, clothing, whatever we get donated and all that stuff. And then it's also a place where people can just, you know, connect with other people in the neighborhood.
That's really cool. And you're one of the staff now, you said.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. When I first got there, all I had was, like, peanut butter and jelly and, like, minor services, but they hired a new executive director. So we've been basically COVID happened and the city basically was just like not there, and we basically improvised and pulled stuff together. And this most recent ice storm, the city was basically like, here you go, we're not going to do anything, and it's throwing all the burdens on our community. And like, and the community is overburdened. If COVID didn't happen, I see the old people who are volunteering, they're like in their 70s, 80s, they wouldn't be able to deal with the new batch of people that are like after COVID, like, and then fentanyl and all that stuff. It's like heightened everyone's mental health, and it's like it's off the chain out there.
Absolutely, absolutely. So you help people get resources that they normally couldn't get.
No, they could get them, but the rigmarole and the paperwork and
gotcha.
The discrimination and the phone calls and the system, like, basically makes it hard for anyone to get on their foot. If someone wants to get drug treatment, they got to wait 6 months. If someone wants to get off alcohol, they got to wait 6 months. So when someone's trying to do right, they make it really hard for them to get right.
Now, what do you think about that new crisis center that's going up?
It's only going to be like 6 beds. The drop-in center was in the bill with the new justice center, and they're basically going to get a new justice center. We're going to get our navigation center to expand. Right now, we're going to fit like 15 people in our building. We got this really small building, and we are just overburdened. It was going to be the jail and us, and we were in the same bill, but most people voted against that bill because like mm-hmm. the jail was getting like 97 million, and we're getting like 3 million. People was like, nah, we're doing the stuff that the jail's not doing, like trying to get people out of jail, transition into something, get them to housing, trying to get people a warm handoff. They like kick someone out of jail or a mental facility and then put them right on the streets, and it's like then they end up back into the
exactly.
same cycle.
Exactly. It's that cyclical thing. It just goes around and around and around. So it sounds like you know the system pretty well.
I don't know all the jargon and the acronyms, but I work with a lot of people. I was trying to do like independent street work with people that were basically like, I crashed with a woman that like people were stealing from her and like leaving bloody needles on the front porch. And after that, like, I start teaming with people because it was like, you can't do it like by yourself. So
right.
teaming with people that know this and know all this stuff. And they bring me to me so I actually know what's going on, and I'm intelligent enough, but some of the stuff they be saying is just like, you know, why are you making the language all obscure for people to not even know what the hell they're talking about? Paperwork is like that, too. Like, this paperwork is like, even me, like, paperwork is like, what the hell is going on here?
Yeah, it is complicated, and it's long-winded. When did you start getting into drumming?
I came here originally playing a bugle, and then a guy that will be coming and playing with me later, this guy, Dave Storrs, he recognized soon as I played the drums that like I was built for it, and portion of my past is playing basketball, so it reminds me of playing basketball. And then he taught me just the rudiments of it, and then I started researching further about, you know, Santeria, Capoeira, and I don't count or anything like that, but I've been
okay.
The drums are, I don't have to think as much. With the horn, I got to think about A, B, C, D, and G and all that stuff. But with the drums, it's just like, that's where the voodoo and the trance comes from.
Gotcha.
Like, then you're going to start to invoking the gods, which for me, it takes, you know, over 5 hours. Like, that's why at about 2 hour mark, I'm just like, then my body is able to do the stuff that I wanted to do. And people don't really have that much time, you know. Luckily, at the Old Rodelli, they give you 3 hours for a performance. So when I play there, If I start off, you know, without that much momentum, by the time the second set, then I'm cooking.
As a frequent attendee of the Saturday Market, I really love hearing your drums. It sounds like a song that somebody who's not aware of how drumming works and the syncopation and all of that. Sometimes you'll have a guitarist here. And sometimes it'll just be you or someone else is playing next to you, playing the drums. So it's really nice to be able to hear that. It's not, because at the Saturday Market, people will play their instruments, right? And they just play sometimes the same ones over and over. Or they bring their amplifiers. You don't need any of that.
Yeah, I think that's a no-no down here. This guy set up the other day, go right by me. Knew I was over here and started doing the amplifier, and then we had to tell them to leave. But there's not a lot of variety here. Like, there's usually mainly like little kids on violins and then a than the folk band, or it's usually typical Corvallis, they're not really intimidated or discriminating stuff that has no genre or is rooted in something else. I mean, they act like they want diversity, act like they want that, but they keep on booking the same stuff, and people want better. People want a lot better in a lot of things. With that skate park thing, I was supposed to DJ. All the kids love hip-hop. I go down there and play hip-hop, and then the person that booked it booked all nothing but punk. So they're like sort of just out of touch with actuality and all that stuff. I mean, when you guys do fundraisers, who do you guys book? Make mixes and stuff like that too, so I'm going to eventually give a USB to one of my friends, Lauren, that does DJ stuff.
So tell me more about the mix that you say that you... Are you DJ?
Not really, because I don't have records. I basically just bootleg everything off of YouTube, and I got a whole bunch of channels, and I mainly, like, narrow down the search. So I just, like, there's gamelan music, Australian music, a lot of, Japanese geisha music. I like early honky-tonk, any European gypsy music,
okay.
Sorts of African music, but, like, field recordings, like obscure Africa, not like some Ladysmith, Black Mambazo, this like commercial sort of stuff. Afrobeat, all sorts of capoeira stuff, and early blues, earlier jazz. And the person that made me delve into different kind of music, because I grew up on basically, you know, R&B, funk, soul, and hip-hop.
Yep.
I listened to Sade first, and I was like, whoa. And then we had a radio station, a college radio station, WCBN in Ann Arbor, and I heard Sun Ra for the first time. I was just like, after that, I was just like, I didn't believe that kind of music exists. Because when people, I play Sun Ra for people, they'd be like, that's not jazz. It was like, because he has these drowsy horn melodies and drums and all this stuff. And everyone knows Miles Davis and John Coltrane, which makes me cringe. I don't dislike those, but it was like when I mentioned Sun Ra, I was like, who's Sun Ra? I was like, Facebook now. I got a number, and you can message me.
Very cool. So what's your profile name on Facebook?
It's just my regular name, Hezekiah Franklin.
Franklin. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So listeners, if you're interested in learning more about Hezekiah, his music, his philosophy, he has some wonderful ideas that I would love to go down a rabbit hole with him on. But anyway, check out his Facebook page, Hezekiah Franklin. So we're going to listen to a little bit of Hezekiah's music. Hezekiah, thank you so much. Thank you. That was Hezekiah Franklin, who's an artist when it comes to drumming and syncopation. You can find him every Saturday at the Saturday Market, sometimes with a guitarist and sometimes just on his own. He has multiple drums, and once he gets going and warmed up, his music is incredible. He's also a staff member at the Drop-In Center and a strong advocate for people with mental health disorders and people without homes. He's going to be performing on Wednesday, May 22nd at the Old World Deli with his friend DJ Nails doing a DJ mix. Also on Friday, May 31st, the Drop-In Center will be hosting an art gallery featuring much of the artistry and visual arts from people who need the services of the Drop-In Center. You might be surprised at some of the incredible art that you will see. It will be across the street from the Drop-In Center starting at noon on Friday, May 31st at 523 Northwest 4th Street. You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics.
Hello, residents of Corvallis. I'm DJ Old Man Winther, and I'm here today with a public service announcement about demonyms. The Oxford Dictionary defines a demonym as a noun used to denote the natives or inhabitants of a particular county, state, city, etc. You may have heard that Corvallis has no official demonym, but whoever told you this is a fool. The word used to describe a person, place, or thing that comes from Corvallis is Corvallin. Corvallin. The earliest known written usage of the word Corvallin is found on a hand-drawn map from 1853, which showed points of encabulation near the boundaries of Corvallis and the city of Orleans, which used to sit on the opposite side of the Willamette River from Corvallis until it washed away in the Great Flood of 1861. Have a great day, fellow Corvallins.